Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 197. It's Sunday, February 5th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily not like my den. Because in fact, this is a first for the show. I'm on the road, states away. So let's see how this goes. We don't have any technical glitches. First up from CNN, U.S. spends most on healthcare but has worst health outcomes among high-income countries, new report finds. The United States spends more on healthcare than any other high-income country but still has the lowest life expectancy at birth and the highest rate of people with multiple chronic diseases, according to a new report from the Commonwealth Fund, an independent research group. People in the U.S. see doctors less than those in most other countries, which is probably related to the U.S. having a below-average number of practicing physicians. And the U.S. is the only country among those studied that doesn't have universal health coverage. In 2021 alone, 8.6% of the U.S. population had no insurance. Not only is the U.S. the only country we study that doesn't have universal health coverage, but its health system can be designed to discourage people from using services, researchers at the Commonwealth Fund wrote in their report. Affordability remains the top reason why some Americans do not sign up for health coverage. While high out-of-pocket costs lead nearly half of working-age adults to skip or delay getting needed care. The organizers analyzed health statistics from international sources, including the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or the OECD, which tracks and reports data from health systems across 38 high-income countries. The researchers examined how the United States measured against Australia, Canada, France, Germany, Japan, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Norway, South Korea, Sweden, Switzerland, and the United Kingdom. They also compared the U.S. with the OECD average for 38 high-income countries. The data showed that in 2021 alone, the U.S. spent nearly twice as much as the average OECD country on healthcare, and health spending in the U.S. was 3 to 4 times higher than in South Korea, New Zealand, and Japan. Globally, healthcare spending has been increasing since the 1980s, driven mostly by advancements in medical technologies, the rising cost of medical care, and higher demand for services. The U.S. has the highest rate of people with multiple chronic conditions, the data showed, and the highest obesity rate among the countries studied. Life expectancy at birth in the U.S. in 2020 was 77 years, 3 years less than the OECD average, and early data suggests the U.S. life expectancy dropped even further in 2021. Since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, more people died from coronavirus infections in the U.S. than in any other high-income country. Deaths caused by assaults also appear to be highest in the U.S. compared with all peer countries. The researchers found that deaths from physical assault, which includes gun violence, occurred at a rate 7.4 deaths per 100,000 people in the U.S. in 2020, significantly higher than the OECD average of 2.7, so it's almost 3 times higher, and at least 7 times higher than most other high-income countries in the report. Where the U.S. appeared to do well was cancer prevention and treating cancers early. Along with Sweden, it had the highest number of breast cancer screenings among women aged 50 to 69, and the U.S. exceeded the average when it came to screening rates for colorectal cancer. Overall, the new Commonwealth funding report continues to demonstrate the importance of international comparisons, said Reginald Williams, who leads the Commonwealth Fund's international program. It offers an opportunity for the U.S. to learn from other countries and build a better healthcare system that delivers affordable, high-quality healthcare for everyone. Much of the data in the new report shows trends that we have seen before. It validates the fact that we continue to spend more than anybody else and get the worst health outcomes. so we are not getting the best value for our healthcare dollar, said Dr. Georges Benjamin, executive director of the American Public Health Association, who was not involved in the new report. The big takeaway for me is that COVID did not become the great equalizer among nations. It did not help our case at all, Benjamin said. If anything, it exposed the existing holes in our healthcare system. To help fix holes in the U.S. healthcare system, Benjamin referenced three steps a nation can take. We're still the only nation that does not have universal healthcare or access for all of our citizens, Benjamin said. Second, we don't do as much primary care prevention as other nations, and we still have a public health system which is fractured. The third thing is we underinvest compared to other industrialized nations in societal things. They spend their money in providing upfront support for their citizens. We spend our money on sick care. Okay, next up, some better news. This from Medical Express. Improvement in the prevalence of disabilities among older Americans since 2008. The prevalence of disabilities among American adults age 65 and older is much lower than it was for the same age group a decade earlier, according to a nationally representative study published in the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health. The decline in disability among older Americans was substantial. The odds of experiencing limitations in activities of daily living, such as dressing or bathing, and the odds of experiencing functional limitations, such as serious difficulty walking or climbing stairs, declined 18% and 13% respectively between 2008 and 2017. In 2008, over 12% of older Americans reported limitations to activities in daily living. In 2017, this percentage had declined to under 10%. To put this into perspective, if the prevalence of limitations in daily living remained at the 2008 levels, an additional 1.25 million older Americans would have activity of daily living limitations in 2017. Similarly, the percentage of functional limitations among those age 65 and older declined from 27% to under 24% in 2017. As a result, almost 1.9 million fewer older adults experienced functional limitations on their quality of life. The improvements in disabilities among older adults was greater for women than for men. After adjusting for age and race, women's odds of experiencing limitations in activities of daily living decreased from 20% to 13% versus 13% for men. The odds of women experiencing functional limitations decreased 16% compared to only an 8% decrease among men. While it is unclear why these gender differences exist, previous research suggests that women are more likely than men to have annual checkups and adopt preventive care practices, and this may contribute to the gender gap, said co-author Jason Farinia, a recent Master of Social Work graduate from University of Toronto. Further analysis showed a relationship between some of the observed improvements in disability across the decade and the proportion of high school and university graduates among the post-World War II birth cohorts. Higher educational attainment increases health literacy and health-promoting behavior, said co-author Catherine Otlin, also a recent graduate from the MSW program at University of Toronto. One's education levels also impact job type, which affects cardiovascular risk factors, and the lower one's cardiovascular risk factors, the lower one's level of disability later in life. Other factors may be at play that warrant future research, says the researchers. One possible contributor to this positive trend could include decreases in smoking, decreasing levels of air pollutants, and the phase-out of leaded gasoline in the 1970s. Interestingly, the study found a more modest decline in disability among those in the baby boomer generation compared to older cohorts. The author suggested that higher rates of obesity among baby boomers compared to their older counterparts may be playing a role in a slower decline. Our findings from the study indicate a steep decline in the prevalence of disability among older Americans. Further investigation will be needed to explore if these positive trends will continue in coming decades as the baby boom population ages into their 80s. So this is really important, but other studies that I've reported on too, this study ended in 2017, so it's a little bit old already, and we've seen, as reported in this study, that more recent generations are actually not experiencing the same benefits as older generations. So while we're still improving, it seems that those improvements are decreasing as we have more challenges that are thrown in front of us. Well, the next story gets at the question of, have we learned from the COVID pandemic to be prepared for future pandemics? This from Reuters. All countries, quote, dangerously unprepared for future pandemics, says the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. The world is dangerously unprepared for future pandemics, the Red Cross said in a report published last Monday, calling on countries to update their preparedness plans by year-end. In its World Disasters Report 2022, the Red Cross said all countries remain dangerously unprepared for future outbreaks, despite COVID-19 killing more people than any earthquake, drought, or hurricane in history. The next pandemic will be just around the could be just around the corner. If the experience of COVID-19 won't quicken our steps towards preparedness, what will, said Jagan Chopagan, Secretary General of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Society, the world's largest disaster response network. There will be no excuse for continued lack of preparedness after having gone through three terrible years. The report said the country should review their legislation to ensure it's in line with their pandemic preparedness plans by the end of 2023 and adopt a new treaty and revise international health regulations by next year that would invest more in the readiness of local communities. It is also recommended that countries increase domestic health finance by 1% of gross domestic product and global health finance by at least $15 per year, which Chopagan described as a good investment to make. Okay, well, next up, we have some great reporting on the oft-overlooked aspect of gun violence deaths. This from Harvard Public Health. New gun deaths data in U.S. show continued rise in suicides. The gun control debate always heats up after a mass shooting, as it has in the wake of the twin shootings in California last month. The summer's mass shootings in Buffalo, New York, and Uvalde, Texas finally spurred lawmakers with action to the passage of the bipartisan Safer Communities Bill, the first meaningful piece of gun legislation in two decades. But the U.S. gun problem is still the world's worst, and new data shows we have a less well-known but equally urgent reason to keep talking about gun control: suicides. Gun homicides, including mass shootings, are a pervasive and horrific issue, and we have rightly focused attention on reducing them. But a majority of gun violence deaths, 54% in the U.S., aren't homicides, they're suicides. Indeed, as the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence puts it, suicide is the untold story of gun violence in America. Both suicides and gun deaths have increased over the last two decades, and there's a strong link between firearms and suicide deaths. Suicide by gun makes up most of gun deaths, makes up most of both gun deaths and overall suicide deaths, over half of each. A new study shows firearm suicides have ticked steadily upward since 2004, peaking in 2021. Suicide rates overall have also increased significantly over the past two decades, nearly 30%. The American Indian Alaska Native population especially is feeling this pain, with suicide being a leading cause of death in these communities. Suicide rates are highest among American Indian tribes, and suicide by gun is a growing issue. But it's white Americans, and white men in particular, who are most likely to pick up a gun to take their own life. Access to a firearm is a major risk factor for suicide, as studies like a 2020 New England Journal of Medicine report show. And while it's difficult to generalize about a whole group, we can say that a lot of white men own guns, and about half compared to roughly a quarter of white women and non-white men, and one in six non-white women. It's not surprising that the group with the broadest firearm ownership and access sees elevated rates of firearm suicide, said Kelly Drain, research director for the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. Despite the evidence showing that access to a firearm is a risk factor for suicide, our public discussion is hampered by the myth that anyone who really wants to kill themselves can't be stopped. But that statistic is highly inaccurate. 9 of 10 people who survive their initial suicide attempt ultimately never die of suicide. These numbers imply that most people who attempt suicide can be helped and ultimately prevented from committing suicide. However, firearms are much deadlier than any other method. 85% of people who attempt suicide with a gun die. In fact, though suicide by gun only represents 5% of all suicide attempts, it represents about half of all suicide deaths, because they're so deadly. Suicide is often an impulsive act, utilizing whatever means are immediately available, says Drain. A suicide attempt by other means is likely to remain merely that, an attempt, but a firearm dramatically changes the equation. Experts say putting, quote, time and space between a person struggling with suicidal urges and a deadly weapon is crucial, to use an approach favored by suicide researchers. One intervention gaining traction is red flag laws, now in the books in 19 states in the District of Columbia. These allow police officers, and in some places family members and housemates, to petition courts to remove guns from those who may be a threat to themselves or others. Mostly they get passed in the wake of mass shootings, but research shows they're actually effective in preventing suicides, says emergency psychiatrist Amy Barnhorst, vice chair for community mental health at the UC Davis Department of Psychiatry. That said, comprehensive data on red flag laws don't yet exist, in part because such laws are relatively new. Before 2018, when the Parkland, Florida shooting occurred, just 5 states had them. But one study of Indiana's 2006 red flag law found it to be modestly effective. For every 10 guns removed from suicidal individuals, at least one life was saved. Other research demonstrates that even mundane gun safety legislation like licensing can help. When Connecticut made gun licenses mandatory, its firearm suicide rate decreased by 33%. But when Missouri repealed its licensing law in 2007, firearm suicide deaths shot up 24%. States with the strongest gun safety laws generally have lower rates of gun suicide, says Drain. A lack of federal research funding has been a serious hurdle when it comes to creating and evaluating effective interventions for those at risk for suicide. After a 1996 amendment forbade the CDC from doing anything that would promote gun control, federal funding for gun violence research was essentially eliminated. Over the last few years, however, as firearm deaths continued rising, Congress has managed to set aside some money. Since fiscal year 2020, the CDC and NIH have received $100 million for gun violence research. It's a start, but a paltry one, according to Lois Lee, associate professor of pediatrics and emergency medicine at Harvard Medical School and co-author of the new JAMA study about firearm fatalities. When you consider the damage suicide does not just to families, but the huge costs in terms of health care, insurance, lost productivity, and unmeasurable emotional cost to families and communities, $100 million is minuscule, a drop in the bucket, she said. Safe storage is another gun safety and suicide prevention measure attracting interest from researchers and policy experts. Rutgers University's Gun Violence Research Center has created a searchable online map that shows safe gun storage locations like firearm retailers, community businesses, and even police departments for people during a crisis. Emmy Betts, an emergency physician who directs the Firearm Injury Prevention Initiative at the University of Colorado School of Medicine, has been leading the charge on how to map safe storage spots. She and her colleagues put together an online toolkit with an overview of existing maps, issues, and how to build a state map. For suicide prevention, it's important that gun safety messaging comes from trusted messengers, says Betts. For many gun owners, those messengers are often firearm retailers. But different communities trust different kinds of heralds. For example, veterans are more likely to respond to military law enforcement. People may find a messenger more credible than the messenger when that messenger seems like an insider. There's also been a huge push at the doctor's office to talk to at-risk patients about guns in the home. These conversations are not illegal, a common misperception. However, she adds, patients are supportive of having them. That was the recent experience of the JAMA study lead author, pediatrician and researcher Chris Rees. One of his patients was a suicidal adolescent whose father had firearms at home. When Rees pointed out to the father that his son would be safer if he couldn't get his hands on a gun, the father said, "Oh, I hadn't thought of that." He thanked Rees and said he'd look into safe storage. "I think he was sincere, Rees remarked. Like Rees is doing, the country needs to pay closer attention and to put in the money too for research. Okay, and next up, another gun violence story offering an interesting perspective on how to view the epidemic of gun violence. This from MedPage Today. Stand your ground laws are a greater health threat than mass shootings. Another week, another series of mass shootings in America, leaving 24 dead in 3 states. Having spent my career on the front lines as a trauma surgeon and gun violence prevention researcher, I want to highlight a recent report by the RAND Corporation. In it, they concluded that stand your ground laws, which declare that people may use deadly force when reasonably necessary to defend against certain violent crimes, actually increase firearm-related homicides. What does a little-known report from a nonpartisan think tank have to do with mass shootings? You may be surprised to learn that each year, stand your ground laws account for more firearm-related deaths than all mass shootings combined. These laws promote vigilante justice, needless escalation of interpersonal conflicts, and are an increasing threat to public health and safety. Stand your ground laws must be repealed. The foundation of stand your ground laws is a legal concept called the Castle Doctrine, which empowers individuals to use lethal force when in their home. In other words, if there's a threat to life or property, While in your home, your castle, you may shoot to kill, even if you can retreat to safety. What stand your ground laws do is extend the geography of one's castle to any public space. In short, you have no duty to retreat from a threat in public spaces, even when you can safely do so. Since there is no federal law requiring you to retreat from a public threat, many states have filled that void. More than half have passed laws allowing individuals to use lethal force in public if they feel their life is in danger. Most do not mandate a duty to retreat, even when the person being threatened can safely do so. The result has been an increase in firearm-related homicides, injuries, and incarceration, with no evidence of a decrease in crime. Ostensibly, these laws were meant to deter violent crime. They do not. Instead, stand your ground laws increase firearm-related injuries and death. In fact, in comparison to mass shootings, which comprise less than 1% of the more than 45,000 annual firearm-related deaths, a study published in JAMA showed that stand your ground laws lead to an increase in 700 deaths per year. That is several years of all mass shootings combined, in the context of the average of number of mass shooting casualties from 2009 to 2020. Clearly, stand your ground laws are a significant public health issue, resulting in hundreds of preventable deaths annually, even eclipsing the human toll of mass shootings. While both types of shooting are essential to address, the issue of stand your ground laws receives relatively little attention. My research interest intersects with issues of health equity, and I am not surprised that stand your ground laws worsen racial disparities in gun violence. The race of the shooter and the victim influence the outcome of cases where stand your ground is a defense. An analysis of Department of Justice statistics by the Urban Institute found that if the shooter is white and the victim is black, that shooting is deemed justified 5 times more often than if the situation is reversed. Stand your ground laws place black Americans at increased risk of violence, death, and criminality due to firearms. To be sure, there are reports where use of firearms in public spaces saved lives by ending an active shooter event. For example, last summer, an armed bystander did just that when he shot and killed a mass shooter in an Indiana mall. However, these outcomes are the exception, not the rule. Most uses of stand your ground laws are actually an escalation of interpersonal differences, and one study of cases in Florida for which stand your ground was used as defense found that the majority, 79% of shooters, could have retreated to safety. We must not dismiss the human toll and collective psychological trauma of mass shootings. Still, stand your ground laws are a threat to public health and safety and should be repealed. The laws promote vigilantism, increase firearm-related deaths, and worsen racial disparities in criminal justice. When lethal force is unrestrained in the face of an avoidable threat, none of us are safe until all of us are safe. And on the legal front, also related to gun violence, this from the Associated Press, federal appeals court strikes down domestic violence gun law. A federal appeals court ruled last Thursday that the government can stop people who have domestic violence restraining orders against them from owning guns, the latest domino to fall after the U.S. Supreme Court's conservative majority set new standards for reviewing the nation's gun laws. The U.S. Justice Department then issued the following statement. Nearly 30 years ago, Congress determined that a person who is subject to a court order that restrains him or her from threatening an intimate partner or child cannot lawfully possess a firearm. Whether analyzed through the lens of Supreme Court precedent or of the text, history, and tradition of the Second Amendment, the statute is constitutional. Accordingly, the department will seek further review of the Fifth Circuit's contrary decision. The ruling overturned the federal law and is not likely to impact similar state laws, including one in California. Still, California Governor Gavin Newsom, a Democrat, called the judges who issued the ruling zealots, who are, quote, hell-bent on a deranged vision of guns for all, leaving government powerless to protect its people. Okay, we're going to switch gears a little bit to tobacco, the number one single largest preventable cause of death in the U.S. This from Stat News. Survey shows a majority of Americans support banning all tobacco products. A majority of Americans support banning all tobacco products, according to a new poll published by researchers at the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. The survey, which was published last Thursday in the peer-reviewed journal Preventing Chronic Disease, asked about 6,500 people nationwide, to what extent would you support a policy to prohibit the sale of all tobacco products? A little over 57% of respondents said they would support such a policy. The findings are striking given that few tobacco control groups and tobacco critical legislators are publicly pushing for a total ban on tobacco. Instead, most legislative efforts have been directed at banning only flavored tobacco products. Over 360 localities have passed laws banning flavored products, according to data from the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. Just two localities, Beverly Hills and Manhattan Beach, California, have banned all tobacco sales. Supporters of a full-scale tobacco ban argue that the findings are evidence that tobacco control advocates need to push for such a change, which was once seen as radical. The public is ahead of policymakers and even public health on this issue, said Ruth Malone, a researcher on the tobacco industry at the University of California, San Francisco, and the editor-in-chief of the journal Tobacco Control. We need to be bold and we need to be braver. There's a lot of anxiety over calling for something bold like this. Public health leaders need to have a spine, Malone added. There's scant data available measuring how the public's support for a full-scale tobacco ban has evolved, though experts told Stat that available data suggests support for the policy appears to be growing over time. A 1968 poll conducted on behalf of the tobacco industry, for example, found that only 13% of Americans believe that a law should be passed banning cigarettes. A 2018 Gallup poll found that 25% of Americans surveyed believe that smoking should be made completely illegal. However, it's difficult to compare the results of the Gallup survey to the new CDC data, which asked about banning the sale of cigarettes, not making the act of smoking illegal. This is a big shift from only a few years ago, when it was hard to find anyone willing to talk about the end of tobacco, said Robert Proctor, professor of history at Stanford University, who has argued for ending the sale of tobacco products. I remember when we retired as prohibitionists, added John Banzoff, professor emeritus of law at George Washington University, who founded the anti-tobacco group Action on Smoking and Health in the 1960s. The findings are also aligned with recent polling from other nations, which show sizable support for ending the sale of tobacco products, even among people who use them. A 2015 survey found that nearly 50% of smokers in Hong Kong supported a total ban of tobacco. A 2018 survey of EU residents found that 40% of smokers and recent quitters supported a total ban on tobacco within 10 years. Meanwhile, a 2013 survey of New Zealanders found that 46% of smokers supported banning cigarettes within 10 years. The new CDC data shows, however, that there is less support in the U.S. for banning all tobacco products among users of tobacco products. Only about one quarter of current smokers surveyed said they would support banning all tobacco products. It's kind of surprising even a quarter would support that, but that's cool. The new poll also showed strikingly large support for banning menthol cigarettes, including among Black Americans, the racial group that most commonly uses menthol cigarettes. The survey found that 62% of people surveyed supported banning menthol cigarettes, including 62% of Black Americans. The FDA has proposed banning menthol cigarettes because the flavor additive makes it easier to start smoking, particularly for young people, and harder to quit. Regulators released a plan last April to ban all menthol cigarettes nationwide. That proposal, which is currently in draft form, still needs to be finalized by regulators and likely would face a prompt legal challenge from the cigarette industry. Robin Koval, CEO of the Truth Initiative, said in a statement that the findings should give a green light to the FDA and the Biden administration to move swiftly to finalize a proposed rule to prohibit menthol in cigarettes. And in another tobacco story, some good news, this from the CDC, declines in cigarette smoking during pregnancy in the United States from 2016 to 2021. This is data from the National Vital Statistics System, which is like birth and death records. From 2016 to 21, the percentage of mothers who smoke cigarettes during pregnancy declined by more than one-third, from 7.2% of mothers to 4.6%. And now for a fresh perspective on pollution, which is an interesting segue from smoking. This from the Environmental Health Network. In polluted cities, reducing air pollution could lower cancer rates as much as eliminating smoking would. Exposure to air pollution has significant impact on rates of cancers typically associated with smoking, according to a recent study. In a study published in the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health, found that in polluted urban areas, reducing air pollution could do as much as completely eliminating smoking would to lower rates of the 12 types of cancer most commonly associated with smoking, including lung cancer, stomach cancer, kidney cancer, bladder cancer, pancreatic cancer, liver cancer, cervical cancer, colon cancer, oral cancer, esophageal cancer, cancer of the larynx, and acute myeloid leukemia. Getting people to quit smoking is a really important way to prevent cancer, but we found that it's not going to do as much in places that are highly polluted. David Kreibel, a professor and director of the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production at the University of Massachusetts and one of the study's authors, said, "The study builds on previous research by the same authors that estimated how much cancer rates would have declined in counties across the U.S. if everyone had quit smoking 20 years ago. That study found that in many urban counties with high levels of air pollution, lung cancer rates would not be significantly lower even if everyone had quit smoking. We hypothesized that air pollution was playing a role," Doug Meyer is a professor at Boise State University, and another study author said. "We tested that in this new study and confirmed that places with high levels of air pollution would still have higher cancer rates even if smoking was eliminated." So this is another example that while you need a lot of large societal public health interventions to help cut down on cigarette smoking, you got an even bigger societal problem with trying to control air pollution, and of similar magnitude as cigarette smoking itself. Now, this is just talking about cancer, and of course, cigarette smoking and other tobacco use also leads to cardiovascular problems, but those cardiovascular problems are also aggravated by air pollution in a similar fashion. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. And next up, a story that illustrates the fact that private wealth often doesn't lead to public health. This from Stat News. Venture capital is investing little in new treatment for addiction, report finds. There are about as many Americans living with addiction as there are Americans living with cancer. But you wouldn't know it based on the world of venture capital. In the past decade, investment firms have poured roughly 270 times more money into developing cancer drugs than addiction cures, according to a new report from BIO, the Biotechnology Industry Trade Group. In the context of other diseases, the lack of investment is stark. Venture capital firms invested just $130 million into novel addiction treatments in the past 10 years, according to the report, compared to a nearly $36 billion bet on oncology cancer. The same was largely true in the field of pain treatment, with venture capital investments totaling under $1 billion amid an unending scrutiny of opioid manufacturers like Purdue Pharma and corresponding push to develop non-opioid painkillers. The lack of investment in addiction continues despite broadening recognition that there are too few addiction treatment medications and that they are chronically underutilized. Currently, just three medications have been approved by the Food and Drug Administration to treat opioid use disorder: methadone, buprenorphine, and naltrexone. There are similarly few options for treating alcohol addiction, and no drugs at all exist to treat addictions to cocaine and methamphetamine. There has been a lot of stigma for investing resources to develop medications. Part of the issue being, I developed this medication, I put all these dollars, and it's not being prescribed. And it's not being prescribed because there's no reimbursement. Just another example that corporate America following profits is not going to produce the public health that we all desire.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, let's switch gears a bit and do some stories on kids' health. First up from CNN. Your child's academic success may start with their screen time as infants, study says. Letting infants watch tablets and TV may be impairing their academic achievement and emotional well-being later on, according to a new study. Researchers found that increased use of screen time during infancy was associated with poor executive functioning once the child was 9 years old, according to a study published in the journal JAMA Pediatrics. Executive functioning skills are mental processes that enable us to plan, focus attention, remember instructions, and juggle multiple tasks successfully, according to the Harvard University Center on the Developing Child. Those executive cognition skills are important for higher-level cognition, such as emotional regulation, learning, academic achievement, and mental health, according to the study. They influence our success socially, academically, professionally, and in how we care for ourselves, said Dr. Erica Ciappinini, assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Though these cognitive processes naturally develop from infancy through adulthood, they are also impacted by the experiences that we have and when we have them in our development, said Ciappinini, who was not involved in the study. Giving your child a screen may hinder emotional regulation, the study says. The results support recommendations from the American Academy of Pediatrics, which discourage all screen time before 18 months old, with the exception of video chatting, said Dr. Joyce Harrison, associate professor of psychiatry and behavioral medicine at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Harrison was not involved in the research. In a learning-packed time like infancy, one of the big problems with screen use is that young children aren't learning much from them, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics. There is no substitute for adult interaction, modeling, and teaching, Harrison said. Babies have a hard time interpreting information presented in two dimensions, such as on screens, and have trouble distinguishing fantasy from reality. Babies and kids are also social learners and very much benefit from the back-and-forth interaction with others, whether they're adults or kids, which is hard to achieve with screens. When it comes to emotional regulation, infants and toddlers can learn from their caregivers when they model self-control or help to label emotions and appropriate expressions, she added. Okay, so keep those youngest away from screens except for video chatting. Improve their success in the future. And moving on to a youth nutrition story, this from Medical Express. New rules would limit sugar in school meals for the first time. U.S. agricultural officials last Friday proposed new nutrition standards for school meals, including the first limits on added sugars, with a focus on sweetened foods such as cereals, yogurt, flavored milk, and breakfast pastries. The plan announced by Agricultural Secretary Tom Vilsack also seeks to significantly decrease sodium in the meals served to the nation's school kids by 2029, while making the rules for foods made with whole grains more flexible. The goal is to improve nutrition and align with U.S. dietary guidelines in the program that serves breakfast to more than 15 million children and lunch to nearly 30 million children every day. School meals happen to be the meals with the highest nutritional value of any meal that children can get outside the home, Vilsack said. The first limits on added sugars would be required in the 2025-2026 school year, starting with high-sugar foods such as sweetened cereals, yogurts, and flavored milks. Under the plan, for instance, an 8-ounce container of chocolate milk could contain no more than 10 grams of sugar. Some popular flavored milks now contain twice that amount. The plans also limit sugary grain desserts such as muffins or donuts to no more than twice a week at breakfast. By the fall of 2027, added sugars in school meals would be limited to less than 10% of the total calories per week for breakfasts and lunch. The proposals would also reduce sodium in school meals by 30% by the fall of 2029. They would gradually be reduced to align with federal guidelines, which recommend Americans age 14 and older limit sodium to about 2,300 milligrams a day, but less for younger children. Health experts say cutting back on sugar and salt can help decrease the risk of disease in kids, including obesity, diabetes, high blood pressure, and other problems that often continue into adulthood. Vilsack emphasized that the plan phases changes in over the next 6 years to allow schools and food manufacturers time to adjust to the new standards. He said in a press release that the USDA would also fund grants up to $150,000 to help small and rural schools make the changes. As part of the plan, agricultural officials are seeking feedback about a proposal that would continue to require that 80% of all grains offered in a week must be whole grains. Sharika Kumanyika, a community health expert at Drexel University School of Public Health, said that if they're done right, some of the changes will be hard for kids to notice. They'll see things that they like to eat, but those foods will be healthier, she said. And in another food and youth health story, this from North Carolina Health News. States that expanded access to food benefits saw decreases in child neglect and abuse cases. States that expanded access to federal food benefits saw decreases in the rates of cases investigated by Child Protective Services, a new study by researchers from UNC Chapel Hill shows. It was affirming to see it aligning with mounting evidence, said Anna Austin, an assistant professor at the Gilling School of Public Health, Global Public Health, and principal investigator on the study. Austin said growing evidence shows that programs and policies such as increasing minimum wage and expanding food benefits eligibility provide critical support to parents that helps them create a safe environment for their children. When families are not overloaded by economic stress, they're less likely to be known to the child welfare system, said Sharon Hurst, president and CEO of the Morrisville-based nonprofit. Just having the information from this study, Austin said, will help program advocates when they talk with policymakers. Children involved with Child Protective Services and exposed to early experiences of abuse and neglect have a greater chance of suffering poor health and poor development throughout their lives, according to a 2012 study published in the Public Library of Science's peer-reviewed Open Access Scientific Journal. And next up, a story accenting the fact that many Americans are in financial distress and stress. This from The Hill. Nearly two-thirds of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. A new survey found that Americans living paycheck to paycheck increased over the last year, with nearly two-thirds of Americans reporting that they do so. About 64% of consumers said they are living paycheck to paycheck at the end of 2022, according to a report from Payments and Lending Club. The report found that the number is about 9.3 million more than in the previous year and includes about 8 million people making more than $100,000 per year. Okay, well, I want to close with a quick story that I think is a good news or an important news for prevention and public health. This from Medical Express. Relationship with food and disease stronger than you may think. The phrase, you are what you eat, is commonly used in conversations about health and the connection between food and the body. Eating an unhealthy diet can have serious consequences and can increase someone's risk of dying from heart disease, stroke, type 2 diabetes, and cancer. Dr. Stephen Kopecky, a preventive cardiologist at Mayo Clinic, discusses the relationship between food and disease. Things like smoking and genetics put us at risk for developing different diseases, but neither are the biggest risk factor. Nutrition is now the number one cause of early death and early disease in our country and the world. Dr. Kopecky says having genes for diseases will increase your risk by 30 to 40%, but having a bad lifestyle for a disease will increase your risk by 300 to 400%. About 57% of the calories we consume every day in this country are ultra-processed foods. While ultra-processed foods tend to be convenient and cost-effective, they are inflammatory and can cause a host of health issues over time. It bothers our tissues, it bothers our heart, it bothers our arteries, our brains, our pancreas, our liver, and our lungs, and that leads to disease, says Dr. Kopecky. It could be in the brain with Alzheimer's, the heart with coronary artery disease, or cancers elsewhere. The good news is it's never too late to change your eating habits, and no change is too small. It's been shown that if you take one bite of, say, a processed meat or ultra-processed food, replace that with some unprocessed food or a healthier choice, you know, vegetables and black beans, after a year or two, you will actually lower your risk of heart attack and stroke. Of the four levels of food processing, the most processed are termed ultra-processed foods. These foods have many added ingredients, such as sugar, salt, fat, and artificial colors, preservatives, or stabilizers. The ingredient list sometimes has words that sound like chemicals. Examples of obvious foods like soft drinks, hot dogs, cold cuts, fast food, packaged snacks, and cookies, but they can also include canned baked beans, low-fat fruit yogurt, packaged bread, ready-made pasta sauces, and breakfast cereals. So part of the bottom line here is that this is really in line with what I would consider the ideal diet, which is a whole food, plant-based diet. And just as a reminder, and tying in with the school lunch program there, refined grains are only about one-third of the nutritional value of whole grains, and it's something that only about 12 or 13% of the grains consumed in this country are actually whole grains. So we have a long way to go. Okay, well, that brings us to the segment called Bonus Articles. a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. I'll give you the link at the end of the list. And I think we may have set a record for the number of bonus articles this week at 27. Number one, we now face an army of COVID viruses. The pandemic has not ended. It is evolving with big implications. Here are six. This is just a good review of kind of the status of where we're at with the ongoing pandemic. And another pandemic news, too. COVID emergencies end will mean new costs and hassles. So the federal emergency declaration is ending, and it's bringing about a lot of changes. And bonus article number three gets to that. Getting vaccinated at pharmacies works. It could soon disappear. This is some of the regulations that were enacted during the pandemic will expire. And as things move to the private sector without public support, both legislatively and dollar-wise, things are changing. And number four, in the same vein, the funding cliff for student mental health. There was funds that were approved for student mental health during the pandemic, and this is ending. Yet another example of the boom and bust in public health, and we're into the bust phase. Bonus article five, public health emergency for MPOX officially ends. So this is some good news. You don't hear the end of the public health emergency reported on very often, but you heard it here. Bonus article six, vaccine makers kept $1.4 billion in prepayments for canceled COVID shots for the world's poor. Just another example of pharmaceutical companies raking in the dough even when they don't have to give out the product. Article 7, nursing home owners drained cash during pandemic while residents deteriorated. So this is another side effect of having a profit-driven healthcare system that's not very well regulated. They can make the money and not provide the services that money is supposed to provide. Bonus article 8, some addiction treatment centers turn big profits by scaling back care. So this is really just the formula and a long series of articles that I've reported on that have to do with venture capital. They go in and lend many venture capital efforts. They buy a company. They scale back care. And then they make a lot of money and resell it. Bonus article 9. Rising physical pain is linked to more deaths of despair. So deaths of despair has kind of been at the heart of the problem with our decreasing life expectancy beyond just simply COVID taking a big hit the last several years. And interestingly enough, physical pain is actually linked more closely to these deaths of despair than even mental health status. Bonus article 10, how patent thickets keep cheaper drugs off the market. So this is a good review of some of the ways that drug companies make it so complicated to actually switch to producing to cheaper generic drugs that they keep them off the market. And in more healthcare shenanigans, article 11, United Healthcare tried to deny coverage to a chronically ill patient. He fought back, exposing the insurer's inner workings. So, healthcare activists, consumer advocates, this is an example of where you can expose some of the proprietary secrets of insurers robbing people of healthcare that they should be qualified for. And it's a good long read for if you're interested in that kind of story. Article 12, tainted drug deaths and weak regulation corrode confidence in Indian drugs. So, we get a lot of drugs from India and China. And India's had a real spate of even killing people, like with cough syrup and stuff worldwide. And the FDA has sent a lot of warning letters, but there's really not a lot of follow-up or things that actually end up happening to tighten up the confidence in the quality of those Indian drugs. Bonus article 13, the Federal Trade Commission wants science to back up supplemental health claims. What a concept. Now, I've reported on this before. This is a good follow-up. And it gives a link to the actual report that the FTC put out for public comment that gives a lot of examples of the type of claims that will no longer be supported by the law, meaning that they're going to need to actually have science to back up what kind of claims they're making. And at 14, another one from the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission is finally ready to take on health data leaks by companies and websites. This is becoming increasingly more common, and they're trying to tighten that up so people's health data is not stolen and used for simple marketing purposes. Article 15, promises and pitfalls of ChatGPT assisted medicine. So this is an AI, artificial intelligence system that is supposed to help people. And the bottom line is, in very limited ways, it looks like currently it might be able to help. But as far as actually, you know, having an AI doctor or high-level healthcare worker, it's not going to work. It's going to be a long time before that comes about. Article 16, unlocking the promise of learning from everyone with cancer through electronic health record standards. So this is a much simpler one about the fact that because there's so many proprietary electronic health records out there that they can't really communicate or be translated from one to another, so you can't aggregate them, and researchers can't look at all the rich data that's available in there. Like, for instance, I do a lot of reporting from the UK, where their National Health Service, because they have an integrated system, they can actually do studies for the entire population rather than these ones just for one health insurer or such. So if we had federal standards about our electronic health records, it would allow a lot more deep and powerful research. And this particular one is about the example with cancer. Most cancer research is done through clinical trials, which is a very limited group, and you could gain a lot of information by expanding that to tens or hundreds of thousands or even millions of people that you would have records on. And you can anonymize the data, so it's not like a release of, you know, your personal records. It's just generic data that they can do a lot of studies on. 17, one relating to violence, and particularly gun violence in society. Can community programs help slow the rise in violence? It's probably the short answer for that, but it's a good example of just some of the stories and the issues they have to deal with in trying to implement these in American communities. Article 18, MRI scans reveal disparate impact of poverty and other toxic stress on brains of black children. So this just shows another racial disparity and the fact that the toxic stress that is present in our society is disproportionately affecting black children. Article 19, drop race adjustment for common genetic prenatal screening test study urges. So this is another one of those examples where there is some racial adjustment that had nothing to do with science. It was just simply racist. And these researchers are urging that that just be dropped because there's no scientific basis for it. Article 20, as long-term care staffing crisis worsens, immigrants can bridge the gap. So this is a really kind of cool example of like a really large federal policy, like immigration policy, and how that links to actually affecting public health through the workforce that's available for instance, long-term care staffing. So hey, bring in workers who can do the work if you're having a worker shortage. Article 21, lawmakers attempting takeover funds for Jackson's water system, federal managers warn. So even with all the public attention on this failure of Jackson, Mississippi's water system that has been deprived of federal funding by the state for years, decades, the state is still trying to divert new money that the feds are putting in to try to fix this system outside of Jackson, which is a majority black city and the city, the state's capital. Article 22, how to take in traumatic news events and preserve your mental health. I've offered these on occasion. This is just another take on how to do that, since a lot of the stories I present are very challenging. Here's an interesting one. Article 23, artificial light harms our bodies and souls. It doesn't have to be this way. So this is one that affects both the environment, our individual health, and our mental well-being, and there's a definitely preventable component at that can improve life and well-being for all of us. Article 24, the weight loss drug revolution is a miracle and a menace. How the new obesity pills could upend American society. So I've reported on this before and include some bonus articles in the past, but this one actually does a more formal analysis of some of the huge costs it would be to try to offer these obesity pills to even a fraction of the people that are actually obese in America. I did a little bit of quick analysis on that, but this article includes that, and it's a good summary of the issues involved. Article 25, 1 in 8 Americans over 50 show signs of food addiction. Now, I'm usually skeptical about this reporting because food addiction can be a very, you know, fungible kind of sketchy kind of process. But this research actually was seemed very robust, that used pretty rigorous measures of food addiction, and showing that 1 in 8 Americans over 50 showed signs of food addiction. Article 26, the link between our food, gut microbiome, and depression. So food definitely affects our mental states and moods, and the gut microbiome seems to be one of the ways that that's mediated. So this article just kind of covers some of that. And 27, not last but not least, what if diet were a vital sign? So vital signs are things like blood pressure and heart rate and your temperature and that kind of thing. So this is a thought experiment offered. And of course, as I reported earlier, diet as a whole is the number one preventable cause of death in the country and the world. Now, I would like to make one caveat with that, is that in fact, I often cite tobacco as being the single largest preventable cause of death. And that is actually true, because tobacco use is actually a much more kind of narrowly defined behavior, you know, either you're smoking or you're not, for instance, whereas diet is traditionally not looked as one whole thing, but as often there's many different things it's broken up to. But if you take all of those dietary behaviors as a whole, it actually has a bigger effect on our health than in fact tobacco does. You can view these bonus articles and all the articles I've reported on this episode by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive. And go do it, because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-